is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, for another live edition of Midrats. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And a reminder for those that are joining us here live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, if that's where you're grabbing us from, you can get in a chat room right there. That is the prime location where if you have some points of order or some questions you would like for us to direct to our guests because you don't feel like we're asking the smart one, both my co-host and I will be monitoring the chat room during show, and we are more than happy to steal your great ideas and claim them as our own, so feel free to do that. And if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on the show here and there, or if you got to leave halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. And if during the course of the live show, if we go over an hour, it ends right at the top of the hour live, but we have a little after show. It keeps recording. You can just pop into the archive and grab those last few minutes because we had one more question we want to come in, or our guest just really wanted how to flesh things out. Now let's get on the show. And today's topic, we're gonna cover focus on the subject, but we're gonna see where the different avenues take us, both in time and also on theme. And we have what we're going to talk about today is there's an arc that spans from the immediate Cold War period through the Iraq War, through our experience in Afghanistan to today, and to look at the observations and lessons you can derive from a frontline leader at his tactical level, and also after he was injured, a continuing service to his nation, what other people can learn from that or at least get different ideas of thinking about things. And our guest for the full hour to do this will be Lieutenant Jason Redman, United States Navy retired. He is author of the upcoming book, The Trident, The Forging and Reforging of a Navy SEAL Leader. It is issue date, its delivery date, its on-the-road date is the 5th of November. And over the show page, there is a link where you can pre-order it, but it'll be out for general discussion here in a couple of days. This is a quick backgrounder on Jason. He joined the Navy on September 11th, 1992, and he served as an enlisted SEAL until he joined up via NROTC, the Old Dominion University. And in August of 2001, he graduated summa cum laude with a degree in business management. He was commissioned in May of 2004 and returned back to service as a Navy SEAL. He was deployed to Fallujah, Iraq back in 2007. In September, was severely wounded, and that's where he began his next mission. While recovering at Bethesda Naval Medical Center, Jason underwent 37 different surgeries, and his experience led him to create Wounded Wear, which is a nonprofit organization that provides clothing kits and clothing modification to America's wounded warrior. Jason, welcome to Midrats.
Here, thank you guys.
Really appreciate you taking time this afternoon to come on and join us. Just kind of kick things off, we have regular listenership. We got a few authors here, and I know there are a lot of people out there that have a book in them. They have something they're passionate about, and they have a good baseline writing skill, and they'd like to get published, or they're in the process of getting a book published. And you got the big date coming up here on the 5th of November where the Trident's going to be released. With everything in your background, you know, publishing a book is something new for you. What's a couple of things as the release date comes up that kind of sticks in your mind that authors and budding authors ought to think about or at least look out for as they enter this particular realm?
Well, it was actually kind of an interesting process. I never set out to write a book. That's kind of the beginning thing. I've always written. I've just written for my own purposes. You know, I took creative writing classes in school, and I've written poetry. I've done all kinds of stuff, but it was always on the personal side. And that's kind of what happened while I was recovering. I mean, almost 4 years of surgeries and all that time in the hospitals, and coming that close to death, it really caused me to start to reflect on my life and all the lessons that I learned. And it was pretty cathartic for me. After surgeries, I'd be killing a lot of time, and I started just writing. I started jotting down my thoughts. I started jotting down my reflections, and it started to develop into more than just reflections on paper. I had gotten about 20 chapters down, and I shared it with some friends, and they said, "Wow, this is powerful. I mean, you pull no punches, and there's a lot of strong lessons in here. You know, you may want to think about doing something with it." So I was fortunate enough to know Marcus Luttrell. Marcus already having made quite a name for himself through Lone Survivor at that time. And I got connected to Marcus's agent, who took a look at what I had written so far and said, "Let's put this together into a book summary," which is kind of that first step in actually getting a book published. You know, you provide that book summary to different publishing houses, and they take a look at it and decide if it's a story worth telling, if it's a story they want to invest in. Because it's a lot of money to publish a book. You know, only the big publishing houses really can make that happen on a larger scale. And that's exactly what happened. Different publishing houses looked at it. They felt it was a good story, and they wanted to move forward with it. So for me at that point, I had to take a step back. I actually had to pause because I was still active duty at that time. So I took my book summary to my commanding officer at the time and presented it to him, and I said, "Hey, is this a story that Naval Special Warfare would support?" And it was a real unique time for us because we had had quite a few books. You know, this is two and a half years ago, so we had quite a few books that had just come out there was a lot of consternation within the community about these different books and some of the ways that people had gone through to publish them. But amazingly, my leadership passed it around. We submitted it up the chain of command, and they felt like it was a good story and a story worth telling. So we went back and talked to the publishing house and locked in with William Morrow, a company that works under HarperCollins, and started driving forward. You know, and it's interesting. I've done a lot of writing over my life, and I think I'm a pretty good writer, but I got connected, you know, with time, and when you start looking at laying out the structure of a book, that's probably your greatest strength. I think there's a lot of people who can write, but if you can't lay out a book well, if you don't have good structure, if you don't have a good balance in all your different themes and the way that chapters close and the way that different parts work together, then you can be the best writer in the world, but it doesn't flow well as a book. And that's one thing that I got introduced to John Bruning. And John is a historical writer. He's got several books he's written that are on the national bestseller list, Outlaw Platoon, House to House. And John and I got connected together, and it just worked. We were a great team, and John really brought that high professional level to put this together in a very well thought out structure, and taught me a lot in how books at that top level are put together, and here we are today, almost a 5-year process from when I actually started writing till Tuesday when the book will be released.
Well, but the process starts long before that. I mean, you ended up, you enlisted in the Navy. When did you decide you were going to go SEAL? And how did you get to where you were in Fallujah on the day that you got shot up?
So I came from a pretty strong military family. My my grandfather on my dad's side was a B-24 pilot in World War II, and I'd heard a lot of stories about him growing up as a kid. My great uncle was actually shot down in the Pacific and killed My grandfather on my mother's side fought in World War II. He actually fought with the French Foreign Legion. They had come over from France before my mother was born. And I grew up with a strong appreciation for the military and patriotism, and it's all I ever wanted to do. So about the age of 15, maybe 14, my dad, who was a Army, he had served during Vietnam as a rigger and airborne instructor, and was putting a lot of course, Army guys. And at that time, the SEAL teams or the UDT teams were going through Army Airborne School. And my dad told me about them and said, hey, you know, you're a good swimmer. You like doing crazy stuff. I know these guys with the Navy called SEALs. You may want to look into that. And that's what I did. It kind of started my own personal journey of trying to look into them. And this is the late 80s at this point, and the SEAL teams were a lot more secretive than they are now. I really couldn't find out a whole lot about them. And looked and happened to come across a book that was the thesis for a SEAL officer at the time, and it was UDT SEAL Operations in Vietnam, written by a SEAL officer by the name of Timothy Pasilovac. And for a 15-year-old kid, it was kind of a tough read. It was very historical in nature, and Tim Pasilovac basically went through all the different key missions that had occurred throughout Vietnam that the SEAL teams were involved in, and talked a lot about the timeline. He talked about the 49 SEALs that were killed during the Vietnam War, and that was my first introduction, but it was what I said I wanted to do, and never looked back after that. Drove forward and graduated from high school, went straight into the Navy once I graduated. I actually enlisted while I was still in high school, and headed off to intelligence school, and then about a year later, I headed off to SEAL training out in California, and spent a year there learning what it is to, you know, basically SEAL training just teaches you how to be mentally hard, how to overcome, how to persevere through tremendous adversity, and then it also teaches you how to be safe with weapons and demolition and diving. And then from there, as you move up within the SEAL teams, you start learning, you know, a lot more of the tactics you really need to know. I tell a lot of people, BUDS is kind of like high school, and when you get into some of your advanced training, it's like college, and the longer you are in special operations, those more advanced. You're getting into master's courses and PhD-level courses, and guys start to specialize in the things that they are very good at, whether it's sniper operations, breaching, you know, mobility, urban warfare, whatever it is. So that's how I went through that road. And I came in 92, and we were still, of course, there was no active wars going on. There was a lot of skirmishes that were going on around the world, and we used to call it war chasing. Every guy longed to be at the team that had the highest likelihood of seeing action. And back then, you know, you might have averaged maybe one real-world thing occurring about a year, depending on what it was. It might have been a non-combatant evacuation operation that occurred. You know, Panama had occurred a few years earlier, so that was probably the largest, you know, active war. And we were getting into this time frame after Desert Storm, where we were drawing down with the Clinton administration and things were really slowing down. So it was a lot of training missions that were going on, and everybody was trying to find that team or that location they could go where there might be something going on. Bosnia kicked off, so people looked at that. Of course, the drug war was going on, so guys were looking at that. So all of us just trained and trained and trained and trained and aspired to one day get into real world operations. So continue to track down that road. I did several platoons, and then I did about a year and a half in training at my SEAL team at that time. And about that time, I'd been in for about 8 or 9 years, and it had been brought up to me a couple of times, you know, have you ever thought about getting a commission? And my grandfather was an officer, my father was an officer, my sister was actually an officer now, and I thought, you know, maybe this is the future for me. I'd like to be able to do more, I'd like to be able to have a longer-term impact on the individuals that I'm working with and working for. So I put in an officer package, and I was accepted in 2000, and headed to school in the summer of 2001. And, of course, all of us know what happened in September of 2001. The world changed overnight. So I was kind of left on the sidelines as all of the U.S. military, and especially special operations, especially the U.S. Navy SEAL teams, went to war. And that was pretty hard for me. Actually, at one point, I went back to my old SEAL team right after it happened. I told my commanding officer, I said, you know what, I don't want to be in school. I don't want to be an officer. I want to go back. I want to be in a platoon. I want to make a difference. And he was an amazingly wise man, probably one of the most respected SEALs in all of Naval Special Warfare, even to this day. And he took a look at me, and he thought about it for a minute, and he said, you know, he said, Jay, I got to tell you, this is going to be a long war. This war is going to go on for many years. And he said, and we're going to need good leaders and good warriors to go forward. He said, I think you need to go back to school. I think you need to learn what it is to lead. You know, you need to learn and get your education and then come back as a good leader. He said, your time will come. And it's amazing at the end of my life when I look back on that, because he was absolutely right. I mean, it was prophetic what he said in that moment. But I went to school, and I watched as more and more of my friends went to war and started seeing guys wounded. We started losing guys, and it was humbling. You know, I'd grown up in a peacetime military, a peacetime unit, and now we were at war, and our tactics were changing. You know, we were learning about this enemy. It was a very ambiguous warfare. It was very difficult to pin down the enemy, so it changed a lot of the way ways we did things. We were still operating a lot off some older tactics, and so it really caused a whole rewrite on how the SEAL teams were doing things. So when I came back in 2004, I graduated and headed to my first post-commissioned SEAL team, and really was drinking from the fire hose. I let a little bit of my own arrogance get to me and thought pretty highly of my skills from being a prior enlisted guy, and really kind of stepped on my feet as a new officer going into that platoon. As we went off to war, we headed to Afghanistan, and one of the first things we encountered as I got ready to head for war was Operation Red Wings. That was my task unit. And I lost a lot of good friends when that helicopter got shot down. And it was an eye-opener. It was suddenly a real shock to the system that this is no longer a game. This is no longer training. Men will die. And the decisions that you make have a strong impact on that. So it really was start of the development of my leadership journey, and I made several mistakes along the way, and the book really follows all of those before I finally grew up and matured to understand what it was to be a leader. Part of that path, I ended up going to Army Ranger School, so I spent time there, and when I finally stopped dragging my feet, I learned a lot. It's a tremendous leadership school, and I'm thankful I got to go to it. And after that Ranger School, I reported back to my next platoon, my next task unit, and we were tasked to go to Iraq, and we headed to Al-Anbar right at the very beginning of the Anbar Awakening to a very active deployment schedule. You know, it was amazing kind of growing up in this peacetime military waiting, you know, to go to war and waiting to go do what we'd actually been trained to do, and suddenly be thrust into an arena where we were virtually operating almost every night, and we were actively targeting pretty major players in the landscape out there. And we learned a lot. We were drinking from the fire hose and going out and operating, but it was everything we had ever trained to do. And it was incredibly rewarding. You know, I would not change a thing from that deployment, despite the fact that right at the very end, you know, I was severely wounded. But even that, I learned some tremendous lessons. So that kind of fast forwards us to where we are today.
You know, at the tail end, and when I first came aware of it, when it got written up, is in your recovery, there's a really neat point because it hit on something that I think it's helpful as because you know, like your former skipper said, this war isn't going anywhere, and people are going to be asked to do what people have been asked to do for a very long time in this war, and more people are going to get injured. And more people are going to die as this war goes forward. And there are a lot of people, family members and civilian friends, and even military, that when it hits close to home, that especially with people who are injured, they don't really know how to react. And I think you helped address that when you posted your famous sign on your door, is the fact that there's something to be said that, you know, not wearing sackcloth and ashes, but the importance of having a positive attitude. I think your quote was fun, optimism, and intense, rapid growth. Talk a bit about what you saw as the importance of attitude and what others can do to help promote a positive attitude to help people who are recovering to get to where they need to be.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's an interesting journey how I got to that point. And honestly, it's amazing how life happens and how I believe, you know, the big man upstairs kind of prepares us for things that are going to happen later down the road. So, you know, I alluded a little bit to a lot of the mistakes that I had made in my first platoon as a junior officer. And I made a couple big ones. I actually made a really bad call on a mission in Afghanistan that almost ended my career. And really, it probably wouldn't have been as big of a deal, but I was just, in my own arrogance, I refused to really own up to the mistake that I had made. I kind of blamed a lot of other people and just refused to step up to that. And that led me down kind of a dark road where I was faced with almost being kicked out of the military, really, from my own stubbornness and arrogance. But and it was a whole journey to go through that, you know, and it's one of those things where you got to go down and hit rock bottom before you can climb back up, and that's kind of how that journey went. And all that's chronicled in the book. But I honestly believe, unequivocally, you know, 100%, that if I had not gone through that journey, I don't think I would have been as prepared to be severely wounded. Because when it happened, you know, I laid there in the hospital bed in those first several days, and it is a catastrophic event, you know, when guys are severely wounded. And I'm not talking about, you know, wounds where you can return to duty relatively quickly, even you know, gunshot flesh wounds, through and through wounds where you may be in the hospital a few days, but your recovery time is marked in a few months. I'm talking about the warriors that suffer the catastrophic wounds that is life-changing. You will never be the same. Regardless of what happened, you have to make it to your new 100%. And it's a real soul-searching moment when you're confronted with that. It's you lay in those beds and you think through the fog of the drugs, and the euphoria from actually still being alive starts to wear off and reality sets in. And you start to think, am I ever going to be the same man that I used to be, or woman, for that matter, for our female wounded warriors? But that's what you really get confronted with. And as I lay in that bed thinking about that, I just thought about everything that I had been through up to this point. And I said, you know, I'm not going to let it bring me down. I'd learned so much about leadership in the last few years. Really, one of the biggest things I learned about leadership, it's your attitude. Your attitude will determine the outcome. Regardless of the overwhelming odds or opposition in your path, It is your attitude that will determine the outcome. And if you maintain that positive outlook, if you maintain that positive attitude, you're going to raise up the people around you. Because that was the other thing I saw. People would come into the room and, you know, I took a gunshot wound to the face. I lost most of my nose, my cheekbone, shattered my jaw, broke all the bones around my eye, lost my orbital floor. So I looked pretty rough. And people would come into the room, and I could just see the look on their faces when they'd look at me. I had tubes coming out of everywhere. And a lot of times it was shock. A lot of times it was sorrow. You know, I think they just – it's hard to look at somebody in that state, somebody that you knew was a healthy individual. And but it was in that moment I realized that, you know, I'm not going to let people come into my room and feel sorry for me. And that's how that sign came to be. I had somebody that came in, and that's exactly what was going on. And at that time, I couldn't write because of the damage to my face and my jaw. I was trached, so I had to write. That's the only way I could communicate. And after those individuals left my room, I penned out that sign. I didn't really put much thought into it. I just wrote it out. And when my wife returned, I asked her if she'd put it on the door. And originally it was on just a regular 8.5 piece, 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. And they stuck that on there. They were kind of like, really? You really want us to put this on the door? And I said, yep, absolutely. A couple days later, somebody else came into my room, a little bit overwhelmed and a little bit sad, you know, kind of said, I'm sorry this happened to you. And I, you know, I was gracious. I said, oh, hey, you know, what happens, happens. I can't change the past. All I can do is overcome adversity and build my future. And I waited till she left, and then I asked my wife to go find me, you know, the biggest, brightest piece of paper she could find. So she returned back with that large orange piece of paper, and we transcribed it onto that, stuck it on the door. A couple days later, a SEAL friend came by, read it, and he stuck his trident in the bottom. And from there, it went viral. It's funny, though. People always ask me, oh, you know, you're the guy that wrote the sign. How did that come to be? All this and that. But what's interesting, if you've ever had an opportunity to meet most wounded warriors, and not all, some guys really struggle with the wounds, and it takes them longer than others to overcome and find that positive outlook to drive forward. But most wounded warriors have it. They figure it out, and they're amazing individuals. And I say it all the time. You know, I might have written that sign, but all I did is captured the spirit of all other wounded warriors. I just happened to take that spirit and I put it into writing. And that's why after I left the hospital, I didn't know what to do with it. And I was fortunate enough that I got invited to meet President Bush at the White House, and I took it with me, and I asked him if he'd sign it, and I told him that I was going to give it to at that time it was the Naval Hospital, which later, of course, turned into the new Walter Reed. But we had it framed, and it now hangs in the wounded ward at Walter Reed Hospital to motivate and inspire other wounded warriors, which is exactly the reason I originally wrote it. And it's pretty amazing. I still have guys, other warriors who I meet through my nonprofit work who tell me what a difference reading that sign made for them, how much it made them. It gave them that push that everyone needs when you go through a catastrophic event. Almost nobody comes through a catastrophic event and wakes up and is like, oh, well, that happened. I'm going to drive forward. You know, usually it may take a day. It may take a week. For some people, it may take years. But everyone needs that little push, that little nudge of motivation, of inspiration to drive them forward and say, I will overcome. And a lot of guys came to me and said, hey, thanks. You know, your sign did that for me.
Well, I should point out here that part of the proceeds of your book are going to Wounded Warriors. Is that right?
We are. We tried to do it through the publishing company, but we pulled the trigger on that a little bit too late. So what we're doing is through my own website, any of the books that we sell through there, the signed copies. We also have bracelets that we had made. You know, my motto is overcome. So we have bracelets with Overcome on there. We have some Overcome shirts, and part of the proceeds of all of those, the signed books, the bracelets, the T-shirts, will be going back both to Wounded Wear, the nonprofit that I started, and part will go to the Navy SEAL Foundation.
Okay. One of the questions that was asked in the chat room, and which I had on my list anyway, was, you know, you went through as you went through your budge, you were talking about how it helped you be mentally hard and taught you perseverance, I guess. What lessons, in addition to that, would you recommend for young officers or who are entering the service and are looking at becoming SEALs or other young people who are interested in becoming SEALs?
Humility would probably be my biggest one. I think, you know, the SEAL teams are a fairly elite unit, and I think it's easy for guys to come into the SEAL teams. And right now, you know, this is a big thing we're talking about in the community as a whole. You know, there's a lot of very high-level celebrity status that has really been given to the SEAL teams recently with a lot of the things that have occurred. And I think that it's easy to buy into that as a young man, as an immature man, and even, you know, heck, some of our older individuals. So, you know, the biggest thing I could recommend is be that quiet professional. Try and be the greatest that you possibly can in that job, no matter what that job you're doing at the time. But be humble. I mean, you should be looking at, you know, what can I do, whether it's, you know, as low as sweeping out a platoon hut to, you know, drafting operational, tactical, even assisting with strategic plans in some manner. But that would probably be the greatest advice. The second advice I would give, and it took me years to learn this lesson, is if you're going to be a leader, you must lead always. I think it's very easy for leaders, especially military, well, any leader at that point, to pick and choose when you're going to lead. So you may decide when you're out with the boys that you're going to let your hair down and do whatever you want. I made some of those mistakes, and I learned that, you know, when you're a leader at all times. You know, it doesn't matter where you are. That position goes with you no matter where you're at. So that's something I think young leaders sometimes have a hard time with. They sometimes miss that point. And sometimes it takes, you know, overcoming that adversity, hitting a couple of hurdles along the way. So I would say the three things are be physically hard, you know, train, train, train. You may not be the fastest, you may not be the strongest, but working out and pushing yourself past your own limits, you know, you may be the last guy in the pack, but no matter what, it made you mentally tougher. And it will make you a better leader by constantly pushing yourself, and it enables you to be able to endure more. You know, lead always in everything you do, regardless of what it is. Keep that positive outlook. You know, it's in the hardest times that it's hardest to be positive, but that's the moments when, as a leader, you need to be providing that positive outlook. And once again, that's something that took me years to really learn. Some people get it naturally. For me, it was a learned process. And then, of course, the last thing, stay humble. You know, you're never above anything.
I tell you, those four pieces of wisdom, I think that applies to everyone. You're spot on, any type of leader. Just that's some great advice. I wanted to you know, bring somebody into the conversation. Because I smiled when you mentioned her a couple of times because she reminded me of a friend of mine, a lot of people in the online military community, Karen Ziegenfuss. She's the wife of Major Chuck Ziegenfuss. He was injured very bad in an IED in Iraq back in 2005. Had a significant recovery period that she was just a complete fire plug at. Which I think everybody who knows Chuck would agree you'd have to be married to Chuck. But that worked really well for him. Those that he was recovering with at the same time at Landstuhl and then back here stateside. If you wouldn't mind for a minute, talk about the importance and the role of a spouse and immediate family in helping the mental and the moral part of the recovery to get back on a firm footing and how that can help the physical part as well?
I think, the role that family plays is tremendous. I think it's an interesting thing. The military has got better about this over the years. I mean, when I first came in, the whole adage was, your family didn't come in your sea bag, so that's your business. We don't have anything to do with that. I think the military has grown exponentially, understanding the dynamics of an all-volunteer force and the tremendous strain that 11 years of war have placed on the military, especially our frontline combat units. My family is just amazing. My wife is the most incredible person, and that's probably one of the greatest byproducts of this book, is I had the opportunity to tell the world about her and how amazing she is. I mean, we met, later. I had actually been in the SEAL teams about 8 or 9 years when we met. I was an instructor at the time. And so she met me when I was still a little young and immature, never batted an eye as we moved forward. Even every now and then I did those immature, erratic things. She just stood by me and said, hey, I'm behind you. Let's go. Let's drive forward. So we really had established a pretty strong track record. Once again, I talked about that time where I made those mistakes and I got myself in trouble and had to dig myself out of that hole and earn back the trust of the guys that I was supposed to be leading. And I tell you, that was another point in my life where the strength of my family, especially the strength of my wife standing behind me saying, hey, you got this, you can do this, drive forward, humble yourself, you're a leader, you can do this. So I think the importance of that can never be understated. I mean, it's always been said, behind any great man is a great woman. And I had that all the way up until I was severely wounded and how my wife went through that. So for me, it played an absolutely critical part of my recovery. I could honestly say that when I flew home on the CASAVAC flight, my greatest fear, I've never felt this much fear on anything in my entire life. And I mean, I had made, at that point, probably 50 real-world combat entry, or much more than that, but 50 real-world missions, so probably hundreds of combat entries at that time. And I'd been in several pretty severe firefights, my greatest fear was coming home with this mangled face. And if my wife, regardless of how strong I believed our relationship was, I was being faced with what is true love, what is unconditional love. And I didn't know the answer to that question, and it scared me to my core. I wanted to think that she wouldn't bat an eye and we would drive forward, but it was that uncertainty that just terrified me as I flew home and as I landed and they wheeled me into Bethesda and, they told me, hey, your wife's outside the room. Are you ready for her? And honestly, I wasn't. But she came in, and she was the rock she always has been and never batted an eye. And then my kids also. I wouldn't let my kids see me in the beginning. I was pretty mangled, and I wanted to wait for two key things. I wanted to wait till I had the ability to get up and walk. Because I had lost, even though I didn't suffer wounds to my legs, I'd lost so much blood. I was so weak. It took me a good week to 10 days before I was actually able to start walking again. And I didn't want my kids to see me that way. I wanted my kids to see me as the strong dad they knew, to at least be able to walk into the room. And I wanted at least a little bit of the reconstructive stabilization surgeries to have happened to hopefully lose some of the tubes and, some of the major swelling to have gone down. So, but my kids showed me that those fears were unfounded also. I mean, kids are the epitome of unconditional love. They were kind of like, yeah, daddy looks a little funny, but he's still our daddy, and rolled forward from there. My youngest daughter, I had almost no relationship with, Mackenzie, And just because I'd been gone her entire life, I did back-to-back deployments, back-to-back combat tours, and she didn't even know who I was. Yet when I came home wounded, it gave me an opportunity to really develop that relationship. And she kind of became my buddy as I'd recover from surgeries and be laying in bed at home, and she'd hang out with me. So the importance of family in the military, I don't think it can be understated, or the importance of family in a warrior class. My biggest worry about these younger warriors, when I learn about somebody who's been severely wounded, is what is their family situation? Do they have a strong family? Because that right there lets me know that that's going to be the defining point. You know, I talk about you may need that time to get past that catastrophic event and drive you forward and say, hey, I'm going to be positive, I'm going to overcome. But family plays a huge role in that. So my biggest concern is when I find out that, you know, we have these young warriors that come from a broken family, or they just had a bad upbringing and the military was their outlet. So the military really was their family. So that loss is even greater for them because they didn't have much of a family before. And now you just took them out of the greatest family environment they've ever lived in, which is that combat core team. That becomes as close a family as any other family you can ever have out there. So those are the guys that I worry about, and those are the guys that, you know, I'd like to find ways to get more involved to support them. And I think there's a lot of organizations that are trying to do that. But the role of friends and family cannot be understated. I think that at times people hear about the severe wounds that our warriors are going through, and they want to give them time, or they feel uncomfortable being around them. I think that was a mistake that I made when Operation Red Wings occurred. I had a hard time going and seeing some of the spouses of friends. One of my friends, our daughters were only a couple months apart, and we talked about our daughters growing up. But I never went and saw his spouse afterwards because, A, I felt guilty, and B, I felt uncomfortable. And now I look back, and, you know, that's the greatest time that both wounded warriors and families of the fallen need that support. So you got to set aside your own discomfort and know that this is when they need that support. They need the people around them that say, hey, I'm here for you regardless. Even if it's something as simple as I'm just sitting there watching TV with you, you know, I'm here. Those are the times when the mind's healing, and those are the times when that thought process starts to develop that I'm gonna overcome this. I'm going to drive forward.
Well, among the efforts that you've undertaken is included this Wounded Wear nonprofit company you started. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So Wounded Wear came about from just things that I saw along the way as I went through my own journey of recovery. Obviously, with facial wounds, I was fairly disfigured in the beginning. And thankfully to the doctors who put me back together, Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez out of Johns Hopkins, Dr. Robert Walton out of Chicago, Dr. Alan Lim with the U.S. Navy, I mean, Dr. Dan Valaic from the U.S. Navy, they all did amazing things to put me back together. I mean, it's miraculous, my outcome. But in the beginning, I looked pretty rough, to put it mildly. And as I would travel for all these different surgeries, and because of the spirit in my wounds and some of the intricacies in my wounds, I actually ended up going to some civilian doctors to help put me back together. Well, that also brought its own level of complexity because, of course, I was flying through big airports to get to where I was going, and all of us know that airports are probably the biggest looking, you know, the biggest observation place you can find on the planet. You know, it's a good people-watching place. Just go hang out in the major airport, and you'll see all kinds of interesting things. But for me, I was the interesting thing. And I used to tell my wife, here I go again into the land of stares and gawks. And walking through the airport, people would just stare unmercifully. And it really started to bother me. I got bitter. This was probably about a year after my wounds, as I was starting all this advanced reconstruction surgery. and it made me angry. It really brought me to a level that I think a lot of wounded warriors and families of the fallen come to, and that is the question of, was my sacrifice worth it? Do my fellow Americans recognize the sacrifice that I have made? And that was the question I started to ask myself. And I initially felt that that answer was no for a lot of them, just because the people who would stare at me, those who actually had the courage to ask what happened to me, wrongly assumed I'd been in some sort of car accident or some sort of motorcycle accident. And I thought, man, you know, we've been at war for over 6 years now. And people don't think that, you know, a young man or woman who is disfigured or has these, you know, amputations or these catastrophic injuries, that it may not be, you know, that it may be a product of the battlefield. So that led me one night, I came home from another surgery, and I went home after leaving the airport just bitter and angry, and I made a shirt and went online to one of these custom shirt. And you can go online to a lot of different websites and just make your own shirt, but I made one, put an American flag on the back, and I called it Wounded Wear, and on the front of the shirt I had different slogans. They were a little bit in your face. One was, I got shot by a machine. I said, stop staring. I got shot by a machine gun. It would have killed you. They were a little inflammatory in nature on purpose, just because I was kind of venting. You know, I had another one that said, they were, absolutely. They were therapeutic for me, mainly because it gave me an opportunity to be in public and you know, people wanted to stare at me anyway, so I was like, all right, I'm going to give you something to read while you stare at me. And I had shirts that said, you know, wounded for your freedom, just say thank you. And that really became the start of Wounded Wear. My wife said, hey, we should do something with this. You know, I guarantee you're not the only one. There's a lot of warriors who feel the same way. So we toned down the rhetoric a little bit, and we came up with several key slogans: scarred so that others may live free, forever recognizing the cost of freedom, and what have you done for your country lately? And that became the beginning of the company. And that was in 2009, and from there we've grown into what we are today. And our new mission slogan is helping warriors rediscover the hero within. And we do that with the clothing is the initial step. I say we're planting the seed. That those original T-shirts have now grown into an entire clothing package. It's almost $400 worth of clothing, multitude of T-shirts and a workout shirt and a polo with the Purple Heart and the Wounded Wear logo and a really nice jacket, and put literature in there, books that can help them. We're hoping that my book will go in there in the future, just because I talk about that recovery process. But that clothing now, we plant that seed. And from there, you know, we can also do clothing modifications. And we do that with their existing clothing. A lot of people always, they think that we have the clothing already modified in the kit. But the problem with that is every guy is a different size. Every guy and gal are different sizes. Every injury is different. So you can't pre-make the customized clothing, or else it's not very comfortable. And that the biggest thing you want when you're going through these injuries is to be comfortable. So we do all the modifications after the fact. And the number one modification we're doing now is for our amputees. We'll take their existing pants and we'll put a hidden zipper in the inseam on the inside of the leg. That way you can't even tell. You know, a lot of people, you may notice that a lot of our amputees are always wearing shorts. And for most of them, it's not because they want to show off their prosthetic legs. It's because it's hard to put on pants with prosthetic limbs. The ankle doesn't bend, so you can't just stick your foot into the pant leg and get it on. So not only that, if you do wear pants, if you need to adjust your prosthetic limb, you have to find a bathroom and, you know, take your pants off to try and adjust it. So, you know, with this system, you know, we're working on, it allows our warriors to be able to wear pants and wear whatever they like, you know, whether it's jeans, whether it's, you know, Brooks Brothers slacks, it doesn't matter. You know, we want them to be comfortable and be who they are. The next phase of that is we started getting into empowering events. One of the things that I recognize is at some point, as a wounded warrior, you got to figure out what your new 100% is and then what you can do with that, and embrace the fact that you're still alive. You know, you may not be able to go back to the battlefield, but there's a whole wide world of opportunity out there and things you can do to live life to the fullest. And so we have an event called Jumping for a Purpose, where we take wounded warriors and families of the fallen and throw them out of perfectly good airplanes. We take them skydiving. So it is probably one of the pinnacle of extreme things human beings can do, to jump. And I tell the warriors and I tell the families of the fallen, if you can do this, there's nothing you can't do. This isn't about the physical act of jumping out of an airplane. This is more about conquering your fears and appreciating what it is to live life to the fullest. And it's pretty amazing. It's an amazing event. We've done four now, and we're excited to say we're actually going to be working with the USO at the next one coming up in May of 2014. And the future for Wounded Warrior to help warriors rediscover the hero within is connecting guys with other opportunities. There's a lot of great nonprofits out there. There's a lot of great businesses that want to give back. But there's a disconnect between with information is really the bottom line. Every organization is trying to find the warrior so they can provide their services. Businesses would like to hire warriors so that they can provide them their opportunity to accomplish the American dream. And that's something that we hope to do as we're moving forward on our mission. So that's our track for helping warriors rediscover the hero within.
And I wanted to backtrack just a little bit. As we come near the show, for those that may have caught us halfway through, our guest is with Jason Rimmel, USN retired. He's the author of Trident, The Forging and Reforging of a Navy SEAL Leader, that hits the shelves there on the 5th of November. There are two things about leadership I wanted to back up here a bit. First of all, one of our prior guests, Jerry Hendricks, made a good point. Your skipper that told you, you know, we love you too, but you need to stay and get your education. I don't know if you're at liberty to share his name. I think that was a great demonstration of leadership on being able to see past somebody. And also, you've brought up a couple of times that, you know, failure is an important lesson. It's an important way to learn things, and every leader has to really go through moments of failure to be able to grow as a leader. Nobody's perfect, so to speak, but in the Navy in general, and I think, you know, being prior enlisted and coming through officers, you've seen it in great detail. The zero defect mentality kind of goes against that grain, where you know Nimitz ran a ship aground when he was a junior officer, and he did okay. What are some of the things that leaders can do at the front? I don't think people leading at the tactical level are going to affect the institutional zero defect mentality, but they can impact their sailors and the officers that they work with. What are some tools do you think that leaders should keep handy to help them as best that they can to get past a zero defect mentality and let people fail, learn from the failure, and become better leaders because of it?
There's a lot in that question. The first one about that leader who basically said, hey, you need to get your education. His name is changed in the book, of course, to protect the lives of all the guys that I worked with. But in the book, his name is Commander Vince Peterson, and he was a mentor for me throughout my career and to many, many Naval Special Warfare members and even throughout the military, an amazing, amazing leader. If I could achieve half the level of leadership that man has, I would call myself a great success. The aspects of failure, you know, it's interesting. So my book, it has a little bit for everybody. We wrote this book, and I actually write a lot about my failure, which a lot of people were like, you did what? Why'd you go so much into depth about your failures? Nobody does that. Everybody writes about their successes. But the reality is I learned the most about myself, and I am who I am today because of those failures, learning from them and having to overcome them. And I think in life, everybody has failures. Everybody makes mistakes, whether you are a banker, whether you are a policeman, whether you are a school teacher, whether you are a warrior in the military. All of us make mistakes, and it is a mental choice to, A, let that mistake, you know, cause you to fail and never overcome it, B, just blindly ignore it and keep running down the same road, making the same mistakes over and over again, or C, learn from it and embrace it and put it in your toolbox as something that you can learn from so that you don't do again. So that's the reason I laid the book out that way. And there's a lot of, you know, there's combat lessons in there. I mean, those people that are looking for combat, that's all in there. My relationship with my wife, I made a couple of mistakes along the way in the beginning that I had to rectify and learn from. So you're exactly spot on. I think that, you know, everybody in life suffers mistakes. We all suffer catastrophic moments. So it's the ability to overcome those. As leaders in the institutions, I would say that, you know, you have to get away from the zero defect mentality, which is a really tough thing right now because I think the military has always had that mentality. And so it really has to go down to the actual command, the command level, in my opinion. And I think the commanding officer sets that tone throughout the ship, unit, battalion, whatever it is. Company level, squad, platoon, it doesn't matter. But and that is in the fact that he pushes his people to achieve greatness, making them recognize, you know, think through the decisions you're going to make. You need to, it's like a chess game, you know, just this was one of the things I failed to do when I was younger. Every decision you make has multiple layers. I mean, it's kind of like a flat, still pond, and you throw a rock into it. Well, there's your decision, and as those waves go out, there are the after effects of that, the ripples that go out onto the shores. And if we can encourage our people to think about that initial decision point, but also to recognize that you may fail, you may make a mistake, you know, and as a leader, it's inherent not blast them in public, you know, and actually to look through everything and to sit down with them afterwards behind closed doors and say, okay, how did this happen? You know, this is what happened. Okay, what are you going to do so that it doesn't happen again? And within the culture of that unit, they're going to see that the leadership isn't just going to throw people out because they're trying to do great things. If we always go with a zero-defect mentality, then people aren't going to take risks. And it's with risks that we accomplish greatness. I mean, being bold, being audacious, but it should be calculated risk. So I think that's how the future leadership, the future leaders of this country need to push. You know, you can never accomplish greatness without being willing to take those risks and their sacrifice that goes along and the acceptance that I may fall short. But then you dust yourself up, take your lumps, and you drive on and get past it. Learn from those mistakes.
Well, that's great advice. You've got a lot on your plate right now. As we're wrapping up this show, what are you going to be doing next, and where can people come see you? Are you going to be doing book signings and things like that? What else? Have you got another book in you? What are your plans?
You know, we'll see with the other book. I've had a lot of people talk to me about writing a specific leadership book based off a lot of the lessons that are in my book, because a lot of people that have read it have just said, wow, I mean, the leadership lessons that are in this book are just incredible. And, you know, it was a lot of time and effort that went in and sacrifice to figure those lessons out. I have friends that always say, you know, there's the easy way, the hard way, and then there was the Jason Redmond way. So, you know, it's that journey through the book. So another book later, absolutely. I like to write. I'm sure it'll happen. We head to New York for the book launch. We will be on Fox and Friends on Wednesday morning. And then from there, the sky's the limit. We'll see what other national news media wants to follow. And from there, you know, we'll just be traveling around. I do a lot of speaking on leadership. Teamwork, overcoming adversity, living life to its fullest, patriotism, So I'm hoping to develop all that and get out there and make a difference with the second chance and the lessons that I've learned in my life.
Well, perfect, Jason. It's been a great hour, and I really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon to come visit with us. And just a reminder for everybody, on the 5th of November is when Jason's book will hit the shelves. It is The Trident, The Forging and Reforging of a Navy Steel Leader. I wish you and yours well, and have a roll out of your book, and I'll check you out on Fox and Friends on Wednesday there, Jason.
Well, thank you, guys. Hey, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate the time and giving me an opportunity to rattle on.
Well, thank you for being with us, and I look forward to meeting you someday.
Both you guys also. Thank you.
Absolutely, and thanks for everybody for joining us for this edition of Midrack. I hope everybody has a great week. And give a nod to your veteran that you know close to you there on the upcoming Veterans Day. Cheers.
Hoping you're the same.